Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to your favorite podcast. This is realestateinvestormba.com. We created Real Estate Investor MBA to leverage the knowledge of giants through synthesizing and providing much needed information to all investors, from the veteran investor to the new and aspiring investor. At Real Estate Investor MBA, we plan to cover pertinent information head on with our expert guests who we will interview on what they are doing and preparing for in the days and years ahead. We aim to create MBA quality curriculum topics and themes from the information garnered among our interviewed guests in order to bring world-class value to our fellow community of listeners. We truly believe that rising water raises all ships. And by sharing this leveraged knowledge, we can create a stronger online community, which translates to stronger local, regional, and national communities. Your hosts are Jeremy Moyer, who is a veteran real estate investor and author of a new book called Are You Playing the Real Estate Game Blind? As well as Tejas Gosai, the owner of eXp Realty, the Tejas Gosai team, and also co-manager in a newly formed Regulation D private equity fund called the Lehigh Valley Private Equity Fund. Now let's get to the show. All right, guys, we just interviewed Kyle. Wonderful guy, knows a lot of his stuff. As somebody who went to law school, I can definitely admire him reciting the codes that he's picking from. But we've always talked about 1031 exchanging, and this guy has some different methods that he kind of unleashed and discovered, right?
Yeah. He goes over the different ways to invest with insurance, to have some, you know, structured installment sales. He covers DSTs. And there's some stuff I've heard of some of the topics, and then it gets into some stuff that I've never heard of before. So it's truly educational. You know, you definitely want to obviously have your advisors around you and have all that knowledge, but it's great to listen to a guy who's very passionate about these topics. And it was a great episode.
Yeah. And he actually, you know, he was nice enough in a couple of places to say, you know what, I don't know everything about that, but he has these seven methods to divert your capital gains. And it's wonderful. You'll like it. Take a listen.
Enjoy.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the greatest podcast of all time. It's Real Estate Investor MBA. My partner, Jeremy Moyer, is here. And we always start with a thank you. Have to say thank you to everyone for making our show possible. As you can tell, we're trying to amp up our production a little bit. And we thank everyone who's left us some great comments on LinkedIn and Facebook. We truly, truly appreciate it. Jeremy, can you share all the places we are syndicated?
Absolutely. So we are iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, TuneIn, Google Podcasts, and iHeartRadio.
We're all over the place. So we love you guys. We thank you. And today's discussion is a little bit different. We've talked about 1031 exchanging quite a bit in the past. If you remember, we had Tina Pashevich on our program, as well as Meenal Babaria. She's been on a couple of ours. So we're always trying to get the best and most recent strategies, tactics, information. And we're super excited about that. Check out our previous podcasts on our website. And we have a new YouTube that we put up as well. Please like and follow us. And with that, Jeremy, let's get the show off.
Absolutely. So today I'm excited to announce our guest. We have Kyle Candlish. Kyle, how you doing?
Good. How are you guys?
Good. So Kyle earned his BS at Sacramento State University in entrepreneurship while also competing on a scholarship for 4 years on the golf team. So Kyle's experiences on the course help mold his approach in business and the finance world. Just like there are multiple ways to approach a golf shot, there are also multiple ways to approach your finances. Through this approach, Kyle has interviewed and researched multiple ways to defer or reduce capital gains tax other than a 1031 exchange. Having not been a fan of the 1031 through what he felt were limitations, Kyle initially started with two alternatives that he helped his clients implement. Over the past year, with the word that the 1031 might go away, he did more research on a few other options that he heard of. With today, that list currently stands at seven. Kyle, again, thanks so much for your time and joining with us this afternoon.
Yes, I'm glad to be here.
Wow, 7 different options that are not 1031s. I'm very intrigued. I'm sure our listeners are as well. So before we, I want to dive in and unpack those during our time together for our listeners. But before we get into that, can you just tell us a little bit more about yourself and how you got started in the industry?
Yeah, well, my wife's actually an executive director of a commercial real estate organization here in Sacramento. And so I was around a lot of real estate professionals. So I just kind of decided to think, how can I get my foot in the door with these individuals, maybe get a competitive advantage or find a way that I can help them out? So I was talking around with a couple of my colleagues and they asked, have you heard of this? And then they asked, have you heard of this option? And I was like, no, I haven't. So I started researching them, talked to the guys that they said, hey, you should talk to this person, you should talk to this person, and kind of took off from there.
That's tremendous. So I kind of want to dive right into the 1031 exchange, especially with no one has a crystal ball. You know, it's currently on the chopping block, as I'm sure we've all read or realized or listened to. But why aren't you a fan of the 1031 to begin with? You know, many investors over the past decades, they've made millions, if not more, through 1031. So I'm just curious if you can dive in deeper on your thoughts there.
And Kyle, yeah. Sorry to be so annoying. Can you get in that microphone? It's hard to hear you.
Is that better?
There you go.
Yeah. So I never liked the 45 days. That was the first off the starting point why I didn't like it. And then I don't like the fact that your basis does not start over. So you can't use the full benefits of cost segregation. So if there was another option where I can defer or reduce my capital gains tax, start my basis over, and not have to worry about a time frame, it makes it a lot better. In my opinion, I mean, I not that I'm saying the 1031's bad at all. I just wasn't a big fan of it, and I thought there could be better options.
Yeah, a lot of people don't know any other options. I'll be frank, I don't know that many other options, which is why we're here. So you went on a big dive to figure this stuff out. Also, some of the things that you're already saying are pretty complicated. So, you know, cost segregation, we've had a podcast about this before. And so, yeah, you're kind of dismantling the things that people are stuck with. And no one knows really anything other than a 1031. So great. How did you, you just started looking things up and then you found your first tactic and then you just kept exploring?
Yeah, it was just so I started off in life insurance. And so one ways that a couple of my colleagues and I, we work with is what are the best ways we can utilize the advantage of life insurance? Well, some people, they have a liquid event and they might have to pay taxes on it. So they had already told me about the first one, which was a monetized installment sale. And so I was, that sounds interesting, being able to defer capital gains for 30 years. I need to look a little more into it. So did some research, talked with a various few individuals. There's a couple of videos up on YouTube on how they work. I would be full disclosure with that individual has gotten very aggressive with their monetized installment sales, and they are now being frowned upon. His method is being frowned upon. So not to say that they're bad, you just have to be very careful as with anything. And so that's kind of how the ball started, was, hey, we can save you money here and then find a way to help it grow for you tax-free in the future.
So what is a monetized deferment sale?
Monetized installment sale is, we're using section 453 of the tax code. I'm sure a lot of individuals have heard of installment sales, where you get from the buyer, I'll pay you $1 million over the next 5 years. It's going to work similar, but what it's going to be more off is a note. So you're going to get your cash up front. And when you get your cash up front, you're able to then reinvest it. And it's going to work similar actually to a 1031 exchange, in that through the process, you're actually going to have a QI who helps with the deferment of the capital gains tax, just like in the 1031.
What's a QI?
a qualified intermediary.
Yeah, just making sure.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, so that's kind of the simple part of it. There's a little more complexity to it. But you're able to get about 93 to 95% of your capital upfront to then go reinvest. So you're not quite getting the full amount. But again, if you go to reinvest it into another property, you start over your basis. And so it's, you gain more in the long run, in my opinion. And I know a few family offices that believe the same thing too.
Do you mind just giving us, you know, a picture in our mind, like a simplified version of an example of that approach?
Yeah. So you have an individual, we'll say, I'll use the $5 million example that I just used for the installment sale. You have an individual selling a $5 million property. Gains is probably going to say, we'll say about $2 million. So what we're going to end up wanting to do is deferring that gain so that you can then roll it into a new property. That's why we like real estate, keep growing. And what we're going to do is we're going to have the buyer transfer the property over to a QI. The seller is then going to have the funds go to the QI, and we're going to have that go on a note basis. It's going to be a little more complex in the fact of how everything works, but we're going to then normally, you're going to sometimes, if you don't want to reinvest it right away, it's going to have go into a drop down LLC where you still have access to the funds, and you cannot you can use that to reinvest in anything other than real estate if you'd like. But that's kind of the whole gist of it, is if you don't, if you want to invest it right away, you don't need that drop down LLC.
Awesome.
Interesting. Yeah. That sounds interesting. So are all QIs, I guess you could say, you know, equal, or do you have to, how do you find one of those? What does it look like?
That one I can't answer because it's with the groups that I'm using. They have their own QIs that they like.
Gotcha.
So that one I can't answer on 100% factual basis, but I would assume kind of once you find one that you like, they're going to stick with it. And I'm honestly not sure even if they use ones that do 1031 exchanges as well. I wouldn't be surprised if those if something happens to the 1031 exchange, if those groups actually start working with individuals that do the monetized installment sales.
That makes sense.
All right, we got one out of the way.
Yeah.
No, but that's awesome. And actually we've seen that in practice before, and it works really, really well. I guess the more basic one, but let's keep going.
Okay. Well, so let's stick with the same section of the tax code, 453. So you have a deferred sales trust. And this one's a lot of people, you shaking your head like you've heard of those.
Right.
And this one is a little more common. It's been out there. I have my hesitations of it for tax purposes and actually IRS potential audits. One is there's some groups will just make it where they're the controller of the money. They're the trustee. I've had personally had a friend that lost a home in Carmel. The family lost the home in Carmel due to a trustee taking it. So I don't feel comfortable with an individual managing millions of dollars of my own money. So I would not feel comfortable with that option. And then you have the other option where an individual, where the individual and the trustee both have to sign off. And then that's where it becomes with the IRS. Is this fully legal? Have you given up your rights to the property or the capital? So that's kind of where it gets a little hairy in the situation, because it's what's the full legality of it? Are you fully relinquishing your rights? And so there's some other things to it that are a little hairy in terms of you need to make sure that it's renewed before the 21 years, or you will have to pay the capital gains tax. But you can defer it infinitely. So, and another option is you can actually get your capital out and just keep the capital gains in. So those are kind of options that are good. with a deferred sales trust, but I'm a little hesitant with that option.
And all the moving parts of the DSTs, do you mind just, again, I think I always learn better with examples. I'm sure the listeners do as well. Like let's just take the $5 million property again, the installment sale. Kind of walk us through like the simplified steps. I'm sure it's pretty complicated on the back end, but just to get a picture in our head. Yeah.
Yeah. This is one that I haven't done. I mean, I know about it. I don't fully know the ins and outs of, but my understanding is that you're going to relinquish the property and put it into a trust. Mm-hmm. And this trust is going to go on a deferment period of up to 21 years, but a lot of firms renew after 10 years so that it starts the period over and over again. And I know a couple other tax strategies, they'll do the exact same thing. So that you can keep deferring what your objective is.
Indefinitely.
And so, yeah, indefinitely. And then once you pass away, you get your step-up basis. Now that might go away. So I'm not sure what the deferred sales trust is going to work if that happens. That's kind of a different story. I think that's actually the most penalizing thing that's been talked about being removed. Not the 1031, but the step-up basis, because you still have to do some estate planning and make sure you're covered for later on. But that's a different story. But you can choose two of what you want to put into the deferred sales trust. So I've heard individuals will just put the tax part into it, or, you know, we'll use the example with the $5 million. You have $2 million in capital gains. We'll say that potentially you have $800,000 to $900,000 that needs to go into the trust for reinvestment. And some firms won't charge you for the whole process because they'll want to manage your money. But if your goal is reinvesting in real estate, then they're going to charge you the fee because they're not going to get to manage your money. So they're not going to make that part. So it kind of varies by the individual.
Awesome. You know your stuff. I love it.
That was good. More clarity on my end. So do you have another one that you want to share with us, Kyle?
You know, I'd like to share the OZs. The opportunity zones, because there's everyone talks about the 10 years, and what they fail to realize is if you're going to invest that money into a fund, it's when that fund closes. It's not 10 years from the second you put into the money into the fund. It's from 10 years after it closes. So if you put it in January this year, and the fund closes in December, that's when your time starts on the 10 years.
Hang on. Let's take a step back for a second. We're talking about a qualified opportunity zone?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. And this is selling a property and going into one of these.
Yes. And people talk about, you know, the 10 years to eliminate the capital gains. And so they talk about the 10 years. That's a big selling point. You have to wait 10 years. And then you get the extra step up in basis on the property, as well as you have eliminated the capital gains on what you originally had. Well, yes, you do. But if you're investing in a fund, then it's when that fund closes. And then not to mention, too, it's also when you sell the building. So, I mean, you know, because you're probably buying real estate more often than I am. But you're not going to close on a property within the 6 months. You could, but when the 6 months of after that 10 years. So it could be 11 and a half, 12, 13, 14 years before you actually reap the benefits of going into an opportunity zone. So,
and just to clarify, so qualified opportunity zones, big benefits on this, but they're also only in certain areas, and there's a QOZ map of where those investments can take place.
Right.
For the listeners, it's really easy to look it up. You can just Google search QOZ and find a territory near you. But that's probably the most restrictive part of it, and people don't understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and the one thing I found too is they're getting expensive. I mean, it's people want to defer their capital gains or eliminate it, but it's getting to the point of because you have to be in it for so long, you're taking on risk because you might not be able to sell at the right time. And also you might be overpaying for the property because of how expensive they are, because people want to reduce the capital gains or eliminate it, which, I mean, it's great. The concept of the opportunity zones are amazing. It's just, it's not as great as what some people might lead it on when they're trying to sell the option for an individual.
Cool. So those options again are only available in those certain places, and you have to be able to buy and find a property. Mm-hmm.
There. Yeah. Yeah. Cool. So that one's a little limited.
That's good information. It's a good vehicle. It's for specific folks, typically fairly wealthy, know what they're doing.
Yeah. And it's really good too, especially if you want to buy the building and start a business in there. It's a big winner, for an individual. But you know, as with anything, there are pros and its cons. So
yeah,
it's, you know, weighing your options, what you like best.
Awesome. Awesome. We got to move a little bit faster on these.
Okay.
But I love it. I love it.
Yeah.
So that's three. Let's get a fourth one.
Okay. I'll stick with historical preservation easements. Nice thing about that is if you buy a historical building, normally they're going to be in an OZ. So it's kind of a win-win there. But it's also a pay-to-play situation, and you only can reduce 50% because of the scenario with it's considered a non-cash contribution. So the IRS only allows you to reduce 50%. So yes. And actual taxable income. So you can kind of tie two together. For every dollar spent on the project, you get $2.45 in tax credits to reduce. Not to mention you can get the historical tax credits piled on top. So there's a lot of stuff you can pile in with the historical building, but it's more of a pay to play, more maybe on the wealthy side. And the other thing for syndicators is normally you don't get to fully reap the benefits with cost segregation if you're not a real estate professional. With the historical preservation easements, you actually get to reap the benefits because it's a charitable contribution.
That's a good one. So you said those are also in OZ territories because they're typically in cities, you mean?
They're typically in cities, or they're in areas that have been kind of neglected. Not all historical buildings are in the best of shape. That's why I know a lot of syndicators are hesitant about looking at them. But I do know one syndicator, I can't remember his name, but he purchased the Rockefeller building in Cleveland, and they're going to turn that into housing. It used to be a office building. It's going to be turned into housing. And actually there's a fund that does the historical preservation easements that are kind of tying together. So that's going to be a massive project.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So
if investors were interested in learning if there were locations within their markets that would fit the historical preservation, is there, other than just Google searching, is there any specific place you can point them to?
Yeah, normally you can check with your with the city.
Mm-hmm.
if they qualify. And even if they're not a historical building, if there's a way that there's ways you can have them deemed historical, if there's a major significance to the city, you can have it deemed, you can file a petition. I think this should be a historical building. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So that'll work really well. It's one of those that varies, from where you are.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
That's awesome. Do you have like a matrix up there? Like, hey, you want to do this, you should do this. I mean, for me, it's like, how do the listeners and how do folks tangibly get access to this? It's difficult, you know, it's mainly Google searching.
It is. And, you know, I've spent some time talking, and I've been through conferences where that's how I learned about the historical preservation easements. There was actually that fund, was there trying to raise money. And so I spoke with them for about 25, 30 minutes at the conference. And then we've done some phone calls since then. So I can gain more knowledge on it. It's the historical preservation easements were really fascinating to me, because you get to fix up a building that has historical significance. You get great tax benefits, and then you can throw in some other tax benefits, like I said, with the historical tax credits, as well as cost segregation. So it could come out ahead with the benefits that you get from the building. So mm-hmm.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
All right. We got four together. Four. We got three more, right?
Yeah. Three more. So, I'll go through this one quickly. It's similar to the 1031 exchange. It's a 721 exchange. Basically, it's an UPREIT. You're exchanging your properties for shares of a REIT.
It actually has a real estate investment trust.
Yes. And I actually had someone ask me about this last week at a meetup, and I have to actually go, talk with the CPA a little more about it, because it's one of the ones that they've done them. But it was an option that I'm just not really fascinated in, because I like my other options better. But someone was asking, like, what happens if you sell those shares? Is there a way you can defer that later on? And I'm like, I don't know. I'll go talk with the CPA that's done them before and see if I can get back to you. So that one's kind of a simple one, but you're exchanging for shares.
What's the name again?
It's a 721 exchange.
Okay. And then you're trading into a real estate investment trust, which are just big organizations that,
yeah.
And you could just find them online, right?
Yeah. And I'm not even sure if you're kind of starting your own REIT at that point. You're turning the property into shares, and then people can invest into your properties. That I'm not 100% certain on. But I do know it's a way, again, to defer your capital gains tax.
Cool. Yeah. Awesome. Let's keep going.
Okay. And then we have a charitable LLC. This is a very complex structure. It's for people on the higher end. Individuals probably having $2-3 million of capital gains or more, because of just the legal work to implement. It's great, though. It can reduce taxable income as well. It's heavily scrutinized by the IRS, because there's individuals that have scheme versions instead of strategy versions of it. Was actually just on a call yesterday about the differences. There's some people that try to use the charitable aspect without charitable intent. You must have charitable intent with a charitable LLC. If you have no charitable intent, don't even think about looking into them, because of the standpoint, they're just, it's not going to work. And then the IRS is going to come after you, and you're probably going to have to pay, you're going to have to pay the taxes and possibly some hefty fines. So it's one of those things you have to understand what you're doing. Your whole tax team has to understand. And that's kind of the big gist of that structure.
I think the reason you're saying kind of wealthier folks too is these are like endowments and, you know, charitable organizations that some of the big companies or big family offices or things like that, they set these up and they have to do them honorably and properly. Yeah.
Right. You're using your own private DAF, which is the donor advisor fund, which is kind of a form of an endowment. So you're using your own DAF. The firm that I know, the charity does get their money. We made that very clear talking with the individual yesterday. But there are some where they try to cheat the charity out of sometimes millions of dollars. And that's just, it's not going to work. So,
yeah. You, good luck looking at yourself in the mirror, buddy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
It's not worth it.
Yeah.
Awesome. We're coming up on on the half hour mark. Let's keep it moving.
Okay, so the very last one, and I'm sure as syndicators, they probably know a little bit about it, but 401ks and IRAs. It's going to depend on your activity in the real estate. So if it's going to be passive or active, if it's going to be active, 401k, passive, IRA. But then also you have to throw in, there's a lot of tax implications with your income part. So you need someone that fully understands how to navigate through that.
Can you give us an example of that?
So for just with like an IRA, you have individuals that will invest in real estate on a passive level. Because that passive level is, you're able to defer the capital gains when you sell the property. But there's other taxes that I'm not 100%. I know there are. I have a couple CPAs that I talk to if I need to know a little more. It's one of those things that you can get taxed and have to worry about that. And I think possibly messing up your retirement account if you don't navigate through the taxes properly. So that can be hurtful.
Is it self-directed IRAs or just regular IRAs?
Normally self-directed, but you can have various parts of it. You can set, I mean, it's going to be mostly self-directed. You set up the IRA and you have the real estate held in there. There's some individuals I know that do that. But that's kind of that won't help you necessarily unless you start off that way. So that's not going to help your problem right now if the 1031 goes away. Right. Because of the standpoint that you already own the property, and be very hard to put that into an IRA or 401k.
Sure.
I'm sure there's ways. I don't know, but there might be ways. Someone would have to do some digging on that one though.
Yeah. Well, one thing about taxes, where there's a will, there's a way.
Yeah. Yes. So yes. Yeah. Yes, very true. Yes.
I mean, It also makes sense as to why, you know, I don't want to be, this is a negative comment, but why wealthy people keep getting wealthier owning real estate. You got to be really smart. You mentioned having your teams together. Yeah, you need your accounting team. You need, you know, your tax folks. You need your lawyers. If they, you know, your lawyers and accountants and tax folks should really be working well together. And there's people that, you know, I mean, they got whole administrations behind their own personal taxes and what they're doing with their K-1s and things like that. It's wonderful. I hope all the listeners who are looking to get into real estate do so after hearing this.
Yes, definitely. It's a great place to be.
Kyle, thank you so much. Just in case, I'm sure some listeners are going to have some questions and they're going to want to talk to you. Is there some contact info that you can provide? We can put in the show notes as well, but just for them to reach out.
Yeah, they can always reach out to me on LinkedIn. Just send me a message because I do sometimes get some spam requests for connections. So if you just send me a message, hey, I heard you on the podcast, I'd like to hear a little more. I'll definitely connect and reach out to you. I normally respond pretty quickly on LinkedIn, as well as you can email me at kcanlish@spencerfs.com. Unless I'm extremely busy, you will probably get an answer within 24 hours, definitely 48.
Nice.
Yeah.
Great. Thanks, Kyle.
It's the way to be.
Thank you.
We keep talking about a lot of these things with this administration and what's changing and what's not. It's a very tumultuous time in that regard. So,
yes.
You know, keep up with us too. We're trying to tell everybody, like, we just want to know what's going on when it happens, but it's great that you're doing these things. And, you know, I know a lot of this is going to affect you and what you're doing. So,
yeah. And it's one person said, you're going to make it, you'll be doing really well. You have a ton of business. I'm like, I don't really care about that. I want people to know. And I don't want the 1031, even though I don't like the 1031 exchange, I don't want it gone. I think people should have options. So if you love the 1031, I think you should be able to do it. So, yeah.
Tremendous.
Well, awesome. Kyle, thanks so much for being here. Wonderful, wonderful information. So we just got 7 different ways to be able to reduce capital gains. That's Kyle Candlish. and my partner Jeremy Moyer is over here. This is Real Estate Investor MBA. I'm Tejas Gosai. We love you guys. Check out our previous podcasts, and we have some great new ones coming up. We'll check you out all over the internet and catch you next time. Cheers.
Cheers.
Thank you. Cheers.
Thanks, Kyle.